Our reading is taken from Luke chapter 15, and it's verses 11 to 32. So Luke 15. A certain man had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, "Father, give me the portion of goods that falls to me." So he divided to them his livelihood. And not many days after, the younger son gathered all together, journeyed to a far country, and there wasted his possessions with riotous living. But when he had spent all, there arose a severe famine in that land, and he began to be in want. Then he went and joined himself to a citizen of that country, and he sent him into his fields to feed swine. And he would gladly have filled his stomach with the pods that the swine ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have bread enough and to spare, and I perish with hunger? I will arise and go to my father, and will say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you, and I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' And he arose and came to his father. But when he was still a great way off, his father saw him and had compassion, and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. And the son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight, and am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Bring out the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet, and bring the fatted calf here and kill it, and let us eat and be merry. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' And they began to celebrate. Now his older son was in the field, and as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said to him, 'Your brother has come, and because he has received him safe and sound, your father has killed the fatted calf.' But he was angry and would not go in. Therefore his father came out and pleaded with him. So he answered and said to his father, 'Lo, these many years I have been serving you. I never transgressed your commandment at any time. And yet you never gave me a young goat that I might make merry with my friends. But as soon as this son of yours came, who has devoured your livelihood with harlots, you killed the fatted calf for him.' And he said to him, 'Son, you are always with me, and all that I have is yours. It was right that we should make merry and be glad, for your brother was dead and is alive again, and was lost and is found.'"
Good morning. I'm the transitional pastor here at Crossroads. My name is Len Helmerson, for those who don't know. Into my fifth month here, still getting to know you all and getting to know the community. One of the things I've asked for, I just want to remind you all, if anyone wants to talk to me about some aspect of ministry here, or if you have, if the Lord is birthing something new in you in terms of ministry here, please seek me out. Call or email or something. So last week we had a child dedication service. That was fun, eh? And the number of people up front here was really cool. It felt like a community thing that God is doing. It's important that we celebrate passages together, so that was neat. Okay, so God loves stories, and when we get into the Gospels, there's really no other way to make sense of this, that truth is embodied in stories. That's tough on us at one level, because we live in this modern world of logic and rationality and scientific proof and stuff, so we love certainty, but sometimes it's tough to draw firm lines from a story. But the rabbis have a saying that God put us on earth because he loves stories. And in those stories, we could write, so we, through our lives, we write some great stories of faith and hope. And in those stories and in that living, we work with God at pushing back the darkness. So we're going to spend 3 weeks in Luke 15 and 3 weeks in this story of what's been called the prodigal son, It's been called the waiting father, the lost sons, a whole bunch of different things. But my goal is that in these 3 weeks, you're going to see and hear something that you have not heard before. Important things about community and healing and family and covenant and inheritance and the deep meaning of God's adoption of us as his children, because the truth will set us free, right? So if you come through these 3 weeks and are not at some level renewed in your understanding or in your connection to God, then I've failed and I'll need to apologize. That's my goal. And I have to give credit where credit is due, credit to people like Kenneth Bailey. Some of you know his work, the New Testament, Old Testament scholar who lived in Israel for so many years. Tim Keller, Greg Boyd, and a few others that I've probably forgotten. So let's just get started. Our first look at this story through the lens of broken community. We all know this story as the story of the lost son or the prodigal son, but I'm not going to tell you that story. You already know that story. The story in Luke 15 is complex. There's a lot going on. What I want to do is talk about an assault on community through idolatry, and it's overcome by agony. I'm going to say that again. This story gives us a picture of an assault on community through idolatry, and it's overcome by agony. So first, an assault on community. Maybe it's the first time, I hope so, that you've heard this story connected to idolatry and to community. Why is that? Well, it's tough for us Westerners to read this story in its context. We see individuals negotiating something. But in the first century, the readers of this story saw community as the issue, as the goal, and idolatry as the problem. This story is about the dissolution of a family. It's a family unraveling. And there are two assaults on the family. One from the younger brother. He comes and says, "Give me my share of the estate." And the way this worked in ancient culture was like this. The older son always got a double portion. There are two sons. So the younger son gets one third when the father dies. So the younger son comes and he asks for a third. But the operative phrase is when the father dies. Asking for this, for his inheritance, when the father is living, is to wish him dead. The traditional father, when he heard these words, should strike the boy and drive him out of the house. Why is this an assault on a family? One, it's an assault on economic status. The father will lose one third of the estate. Two, it's absolute humiliation. It's a big shame on the family. The family's good name is assaulted. Three, the son is saying, "I'm out of here. I don't want to be part of this family." And four, the son is brought back in at the end of the story, but triumph turns to disaster when the older brother refuses to come in. Essentially, the older son is saying, "This inheritance is mine and I will not be part of this family." So the root of all this, the family, is the basic model for community, and both children assault the family. So this is an assault on community. And what's the cause? Why does this happen? If you read carefully, it's idolatry, but that word doesn't occur here. That's the reality. Here's how it works. The younger son has been part of the family. He eats with the family. He obeys the father. He's been working and contributing to the life of the family. But when he says, "I'm tired of waiting for you to die," it means that for a long time, he has been after the father's things more than the connection, more than the relationship. He wanted stuff, not sonship. He must have come to a turning point. Maybe he'd been playing both ends, hoping he could have relationship and the stuff, but finally he chose, showing that his heart was not on the father at all, but rather on the stuff. So this is a narrative telling of idolatry. It's idolatry pictured in a story. So you can be in church, you can pray and observe and serve, you can relate to the Father, but all along your heart can be set on the Father's things. What are the Father's things? Blessing? Health? Wealth? So you're always asking for things. It's about God's stuff, not about God. That's younger brother idolatry. It's hard to see. On the outside, it can look okay. Hey, I'm doing everything right. But you come to a turning point and your cards are on the table and you say, "Give me mine, I'm out of here." Maybe the turning point happens when your prayers aren't answered. Your sister didn't live. You didn't get the job that should be yours. And you realize, God didn't do it my way. But the truth is, you've been using God, not loving God, and that's where your heart has been. And you can say, well, hey, it's not me. Here I am listening to you. But there's a second kind of idolatry. When the older brother finds out the son is back, and you don't need a degree in psychology, it's the greatest day in the father's life. So they kill the fatted calf. Fat calf would feed 75 to 100 people. They didn't eat a lot of meat. It's a delicacy. So by killing this thing, he's throwing a party for the whole village. It's a big deal. It's a great day. But all the older brother can see is that the father is using up his inheritance now. Clearly shows that his heart also has been on the father's things, not on the father. He refuses to come in. This is as much an assault on the family as the first part of the story. It looked like the problem, or the only problem, was with the younger son. Now we know the heart of the older brother. His heart has also been wrong. So younger brother idolatry shows in moral issues. Older brother lostness shows in self-righteousness and anger. The father owes me. I've done it right. I've earned this. The anger shows where the heart is. This isn't obedience because the father is worthy of it, because the son loves him and wants to be near him. So both responses show types of idolatry, and both responses destroy community. How does that work? St. Augustine, a great writer on idolatry, writes in the Confessions, he tells his story, and he had trouble with two things, food and sex. So Augustine is driven by beauty, beautiful food, beautiful bodies, beautiful things. But as he goes along, he realizes he feels empty. Three things are happening to his life. He's always unsatisfied. He's doing things he doesn't want to do and can't stop. And his relationships keep fracturing and breaking up. He was trying to figure out what was wrong with him, and he sought God's heart, and he came up with a theory that all our problems come from disordered loves. So in the Confessions chapter 5, he writes this. So you say a man has murdered someone. What was his motive? Either he desired his wife or his property, or maybe he was afraid of losing something to him, or maybe having been injured, he was burning to be avenged. So let's ask again, why does any man commit murder? Answer, any man who commits murder does so because he loves something. He loves something too much, and that's the motive for his crime. Isn't that interesting? If you see murder, it's because somebody loves something too much. He goes on and he explains, there's a splendor to all bodies that are beautiful to the eye. The sense of touch and taste have their own power to please. Worldly honor, too, has its own glory, as does the power to command. The bond of human friendship has a sweetness all its own, binding souls together. But in the way we seek these pleasures, it's in the way we seek these pleasures that the sin is committed, because we have an inordinate love for the goods of a lower order and neglect the better and the higher order, neglecting you, Lord our God, and your truth and your law. For these inferior things have their delights, but they're not equal to you, God, who has made them all. Therefore, when we inquire why a sin was committed, we don't accept the explanation unless it appears how the heart was set on some of those values which are inferior to the superior and heavenly goods. Okay, so what does this mean? Material things, money, possessions, are not as valuable and important as human beings, right? Human beings are a higher order of good. A great roast turkey is good, but not as important as a human being. But human beings are not as important or as valuable or as glorious as God. If you put money and possessions over relationships, over people, over family, over friendship, it's a disordered love. You're loving something as if it was first or second when it should only be third in your heart. It's a disordered love. But, says Augustine, if you love something, human beings which are second, as if they were God, as if their love and their honor and their beauty is the ultimate beauty, that will satisfy your desire for love and honor and beauty. That is a disordered love. And all disordered loves lead to brokenness. And all the problems that you and I have in our in your life, all the problems we have in the world, come from disordered love. How can that be? Here's why. Because disordered love, that means making a good thing into an ultimate thing, creates three problems in us. It starves you, it emotionally enslaves you, and it divides you. First, it starves you. You know Augustine's famous statement, the Confessions, our hearts are restless. Here's how that statement begins. What does ambition seek except honor and glory? But only you, Lord, have a glory that can never be lost. What does power of the mighty desire except to be feared? But none has power that can never be stolen except you. What do the lonely and anxious long for except a love that they cannot lose? But who can give a love that does not fade and die but you? What does weariness seek except rest? But what sure rest is there apart from you? Thus the soul commits adultery whenever it turns from you to seek those things that it cannot find except in you. O Lord, you made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you. Now here's what sin is. It's not sinful to want honor. It's not sinful to want love. It's not even sinful to want power or rest. But the sin in our hearts makes us seek a kind of honor, a kind of power, a kind of love or rest in creatures, in creation, in the Father's things, rather than in the Father. So we put our highest hopes for honor in how we're doing our work. We put our highest hopes for love in some other human being, and that will destroy them and you. Why? First of all, they can't give it because that's empty, right? And secondly, emotionally enslaved. There's a place where Augustine says that the real problem is that when you see something you love, you want to rest in it. And the problem is there is no source of honor or love or power or rest that you can absolutely rest in except God. And this is the problem of the older brother, because his heart was, I'm going to get all this money. I'm going to have everything now. And when it's jeopardized, he goes ballistic. Why? Here's why. If you want a good name and someone ruins your good name, you're mad. But if you make your good name into the ultimate honor because you don't really know God, then you're getting your value, your self-image from what people say. And you're turning a good thing into an ultimate thing. And then someone ruins your good name, you go ballistic. You might kill them. To know that suddenly your father is giving away part of your inheritance, you're expecting to have X, Y, Z, and now only this, that'll make you sad. But when that's the ultimate thing in your life, when that's how you actually feel good about yourself, when that's where you put your hope and someone starts to shrink it, then you go ballistic and you know, you might kill. That's what Augustine means. Here's the reason why then, the ultimate reason why this divides us, why idolatry kills community. Now we can see how it works. And there's another connection that we should make here, and it's to the Trinity. We had a great song about the Trinity today. Praise the Father, praise the Son, praise the Spirit, three in one. Okay, so where does that come from? There's no one like Augustine who's good at explaining the Trinity. And I know this doctrine is complicated. It's a strain to the mind, three beings and one God and only one God. Here's what Augustine says. If the world is here by accident, if there is no God, then the meaning of life, ultimate reality, is basically impersonal. You're here because of accidental forces and eruptions. Secondly, he says, if there is a God, but a unipersonal God, a God that's only one personality, then that God would not have known love until he created the universe, filled with angels and human beings, because you can't love until there's someone to love, more than one person. And if there was one God, a unipersonal God, before he made the universe, he would have had power, but not love, and only felt love later. So love would have been second. Love would have been peripheral, right? And therefore, if there is no God, what life is really about is power. And if there's a unipersonal God, then power is more important than anything else. It's first. But if the Christian story, the Christian God, is a heart of reality, if God is triune, then that means before creation, before they exercised their power to create the world, the Father and Son and Holy Spirit was already a community. A community of beings loving and knowing one another and communicating with each other. And that means that community, loving relationships, are the ultimate meaning of life. It's ultimate reality. It comes before achievement. It comes before building. It comes before power. It comes first. And the infinite happiness of God and of the love of God works like this. We know from what Jesus has told us. The Father glorifies the Son. The Son glorifies the Father. And the Holy Spirit glorifies the Father and the Son. What does that mean? Each person, each divine person serves the others, glorifies the others, adores the others, does not take glory, but gives it. And if we are made in the image of that God, then there are two bottom lines for our existence, and they anchor this whole parable. One, your life is about community. Loving relationships. That's what life is all about. Like the line in the Eagles song, "Don't try the Queen of Diamonds, boy. She'll beat you if she's able. The Queen of Hearts is always your best bet." If you make anything your goal other than love, if you put individual achievement, status, or wealth ahead of community, you will dash yourself on the rocks of reality. You were not made for that. There will be brokenness in your life. But secondly, not just relationships are important, but you were built to do with God what God does within himself. Each of the divine persons centers on the others. They don't say, me, me, me. Each one gives glory to the other. And if we're made in God's image, then you were meant to put God at the center of your life. You were meant to say, I will do God's purposes, not my own. And if you do that, then you will know God's rest and God's peace, because God will fulfill your deep needs, your need for honor and power and love and rest. But if you seek those things in other finite beings, you know what will happen. You'll be too broken, too angry, too needy, like the older brother, or too addicted, like the younger brother, to care about others. You have to have those disordered loves healed so that God is the beauty and the center in your life. And the most important thing, you can't just believe in him or just obey him. You might just be a younger brother or an elder brother. You have to center your life completely in him. You have to be able to say, I don't care what he gives me. I don't even care, in one sense, what prayers you answer. I love you. And I find you not just useful to get things, but beautiful and worthy of adoration. And I serve you for who you are in yourself. Now, remember what I said that the commentators say about this, what a Middle Eastern patriarch would have done when the younger son came to demand his inheritance. He would have slapped his face, and he should have driven him out of the house with physical and verbal blows. And I'll tell you why most of us would do that. When you're hurt badly by somebody, you want to hurt them back. Sort of staunches the wound. You turn your care and admiration for that person into anger and bitterness, and it closes and protects your heart. And you say to yourself, why did I ever see anything in that person? So it lessens the hurt. If the father had done that, there never would have been reconciliation. The son would never have come back. And even if he had come back, the father's heart would not have opened. So what does the father do? One of the things that the commentators in this story find fascinating, it says there that after the younger brother asks for his inheritance, it says, and so the father divided his property between them. But the word there is not the typical Greek word for property or possessions. It's a strange word. For some reason, Jesus uses the word bios here, the Greek word for life. Biosphere, biology. Why this word? The only way for the father to give his son a third of the property, they didn't have bank accounts or ATMs, the only way he could give a third of his estate is to sell his land. He would have had to sell his inheritance, his ancestral land, land passed on for generations. Some of you know these old movies. There's a movie called Oklahoma, an old musical. There's a line in that in a song, Oklahoma. We belong to the land. and the land we belong to is grand. We barely know what that means anymore. Most of us don't belong to a piece of land. Maybe our fathers did. It doesn't say the land belongs to us. That's our thinking. It says we belong to the land. In older times, a family's land was their life. It was their livelihood. It was part of their identity. So what the text is telling us is that the younger son, because of his sin, the only way the father can keep open the possibility of salvation is for him to tear his life apart. He divided his life. He tore his life apart. You see, the way we would have dealt with this, we would have thrown this pain on the son. We would not have taken it on ourselves. But this father, he suffered for his son's sin. He suffered for the possibility of redemption. He bore the agony of his son's sin so that eventually they could be reconciled. Near the end of the Confessions, Augustine tells us how his soul is healed. He says, "It's all about beauty." Because if I just sit there, say I hear a good sermon, not like this one, but a good one, and I sit there and I say, okay, I need to love God more or my life will be screwed up and my family will be screwed up. I have to like God more and serve God more than my money or status. Okay, I got it, yeah. Augustine says that doesn't work. You can't do it with an act of the will. He says we're made for beauty. When you see something beautiful, you can't help but be attracted. We're converted by beauty. Beauty engages action. The answer to our problems, to disordered loves, is that we have to see God more clearly. This is what happened to Augustine. He says, "How have you loved me, O Father, who did not spare your only Son, but delivered him up for us? How have you loved me, Lord Jesus, who, though equal to the Father, became obedient by death, death on a cross? Father, your Son became both victor and victim for us. Victor because he was the victim. Father, your Son became both priest and sacrifice for us. Priest because he was the sacrifice. Out of slaves, he made us sons because though he was a son, he became a slave and served you and us instead of himself. Rightly then is my hope fixed strongly on him, and this will heal all the diseases of my soul." There's nothing more beautiful. There's no more beautiful sight or even thought than this, that an infinitely perfect and happy being would descend into this world and sacrifice everything for his rebellious creation, for human beings like us. An infinitely happy being tore his life apart for us. If you get even a glimpse of the beauty of this, it will heal the diseases of your soul. You will have to engage. You will have to be converted, and the center of your life will change, and you'll discover a place for love in your heart that you have never known. I just want to give you a minute to talk to God about where this has taken you. Just a minute of silence, and then I'll pray, and we'll worship together.